In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and the person who I'm talking with today is Henry O'Donovan. He's actually runs Bondi Tunes International, and he's a dear friend of mine and colleague. And I'm speaking to Henry today about his life. How are you, Henry?
I'm good, thank you very much. It's very strange being on the other side of the microphone, so to speak.
Today is my time to speak with you and asking questions about your life.
Yes, and my life has been rather strange, to say the very least.
Thank you for the opportunity. When you asked me to give you this interview, when I looked at your profile, I could cry. You were deserted by your parents and put in a children's home when you were still in nappies. You were not an orphan. This is unbelievable.
Well, the thing is, my parents didn't know how to actually have children. And they had their first child in 1957. My eldest sister was born in 1957. In those days, my father was actually the son of a very wealthy and famous father. That was his father. And he didn't really know how to keep up with those times. And so I guess he just didn't. He just didn't. And in 1957, my elder sister, who was born then, was looked after by our auntie. And in a place called Drimna in Dublin, a working class suburb of Dublin. Then by 1961, of course, my sister was born, and then 62, I was born, and we were thrown into children's homes. We had no choice. Of course we had no choice. We didn't know what was going on. And all of a sudden we're in children's homes, and they were tough times in the early 1960s. You know, it was pretty tough going. We just knew our environment, and that was it, you know.
So both you and your sister were put into children's homes together at the same time?
At the same time, yes.
Did you both stay together and protecting one another during all those times when you were grown up?
Well, you know, I was put into children's homes at the age of 1.5. So I didn't, you know, that's 18 months old. I didn't know that, you know, how tough this would be. I didn't know anything else, Ling. I just didn't know anything else. It was just me and my sister. We suddenly had 22. We had suddenly 22 other children who were to become our
family,
sisters and brothers. Yes, yes.
Did you all get on together like a big family?
The thing is that we, you know, I remember getting a present at Christmas, which was a melon. And I didn't know what to do with it, because what happened in those days back in the 60s was the people who sponsored the children's home, they would give us all these presents. And I got this present of a melon, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I left it too long, and it rotted. And I said to the people who are looking after us in this children's home, I said, why? Why is this happening? Why is the melon rotting? I didn't know it should have been put in a fridge. I'm talking 2 months later. You know what I mean?
It's really difficult for anyone to be living in a children's home as an orphan, or in your circumstances, your sister. It is very unusual that you have parents, but yet put in the children's home. But yet, in at those times growing up, were you guys allowed to be free and play like any other children and interact like other people, and also understanding what's going on around the world outside?
Yes, we were, in answer to your question. Yes, absolutely. We were allowed to have fun with our friends. It felt like home. We didn't know anything. You see, you got to understand, Ling, we didn't know anything else apart from our own existence. We didn't know that we were not from a traditional family home, like most people are. We didn't have a father and a mother. They were alive, as you mentioned earlier. They were alive, but we didn't know that we didn't know about a home environment. We only knew about this place that we're, as I said earlier on, that was 1.5 years old. I didn't know. I didn't know there was anything different. And we grew up in great conditions, I must say. You got to remember, in Ireland in the 1970s, you know, we were brought up Catholic. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Protestant. Mm-hmm. And the Catholics, we all know about the stories of what happened, the dreadful stories of what happened in Catholic children's homes in the 1960s. We were in a Protestant place and we were safe. The whole place was run by women. The women were great. They were tough. I had the headmistress, if you like, the woman in charge, slapped me across the face because I didn't get rid of graffiti on a wall back in the late 60s, early 70s. They were tough women, and they had to be. They were working for nothing, for goodness sake, you know?
Mm-hmm. So they use sponsors' money, charitable money, to support children.
Rich people. Oh. Rich people looked after our well-being as children in this children's home. Rich Protestants. Mm-hmm. You got to remember Northern Ireland. Mm. The southern part of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. At the time, there was, you know, what they call the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Southern Ireland, it was different if you were a Protestant, because most of the rich people were Protestants, and that's the bottom line. I mean, that's the truth. And we happened to be Protestant, and we were looked after. You know, we were looked after properly. And I have great, you know, Ling, I've got great memories of times in the children's home. A lot of people stereotype this kind of stuff. And you mentioned, you know, the word orphan. We weren't orphans, and you noted that we weren't actually orphans. We had parents who just couldn't control us. They didn't know how to look after children. And that's what happened. They were very naive. They just didn't know how to do it. And, you know, we did have a good time. And I want to make that clear to our listeners, that we did have a good time. It was a good time. It was weird. We didn't know what was going on, but we had a good time back in the 1960s when we were not even, you know, we weren't even teenagers. We were very young.
Did you and your sister get to see your parents very much at all?
Yes, we did, but not very much. My mother was working in England, working in hotels in England. She was making up beds and that kind of stuff in hotels. That was her gig. My father was in Dublin, where I was being raised, in the children's home. He would come and visit with his big black beard, which I always remember this, because he was, you know, when you look at what's going on with the kids now, in their 20s, they've all got big black beards. And my father had it in the 1960s. And he actually brought me, at one stage in the children's home, he brought me a record player. And he brought me an album, which was The Beatles, Hard Day's Night. And that was the mid-1960s. And he, as a musician, always said, I don't think they're ever going to make it. And my mother, you know, I spoke to her before she died in 2012. She said he always thought they'd never, because he was a musician, okay? She said he always said the Beatles would never make it. And of course, we all know what the story is with the Beatles. But he brought a record player and a record, the actual album of A Hard Day's Night, to me in the children's home. And I think it was 1969 when I was about 7 years old.
For you at the time, must be something that you could turn to, you could listen to. That possibly got you interested in doing radio work afterwards, do you think?
Well, you know, I discovered recently that my grandfather was actually, you know, he was in radio back in the 20s and 30s, Radio Television, RTE, the Irish National Broadcaster. I eventually knew that he was in the medium, and he was a comedic actor and did lots of stuff on stage in Ireland. And I only realized afterwards, and it must have been in my blood, because I remember the age of 7. I just wanted to be on radio. I didn't know why. I just wanted to be in that box. And I became someone who was in that box. You know, and my grandfather was on radio and I didn't even know it. So there must be some molecular connection between what's happened, you know, with him in the 1930s and 1940s and me being a broadcaster in the late 1970s and 1980s.
No, it's no coincidence, is it? It's in your blood.
Well, it must have been.
Yeah.
I don't know. To this day, I don't know. But, and sadly, my grandfather is dead, and so is my father. So I can't ask them. But I've always wondered if, you know, it was in my blood, if I wanted to do all this stuff on radio, which I did in the late 1970s, going out of the boarding school in Limerick in the west of Ireland and going on to radio when I was only 15. And then later on, you know, working on crappy little radio stations in the middle of nowhere.
Before you were involved in radio, you said you were sent to boarding school. Was that a different establishment to the children's home?
No, it was very similar because everything was controlled. We were controlled. Everything was controlled. I was used to it. Like, I only knew about children's homes. And when I went to the boarding school in the late 70s, I actually felt no change, except it was on the other side of the country. I wasn't in Dublin anymore, where I grew up. And I'm from Dublin. It was suddenly in Limerick. And And I'm writing a book about this at the moment. My big thing was the fact that I had to make all these new friends, because you got to remember, in the children's home, I was, you know, with all these people for 6 years. These kids, they were my sisters and brothers. And all of a sudden, they were being thrown out and I was being shoved into a boarding school in the west of Ireland, on the other side of that country. And I was not happy about that. The year was 1974. And I was 12 and all of a sudden had to make a whole new set of friends. And that's when I snuck out windows of the boarding school to work on radio.
Why pirate radio? I understand that they broadcast without a valid license. Is that how you first taste of radio?
Yeah. Pirate radio is an interesting term for our international listeners. Pirate radio actually started in Britain in the 1960s with Radio Caroline, Radio North Sea International, big pirate stations. What they did was they set up radio stations on ships outside British waters in the UK. I'm talking about the UK here. And Radio Caroline, it's a rich cultural history of radio in the UK. And the reason they did was because a guy called Ronan Rattley actually set this up, because he couldn't promote bands like the Beatles on radio in Britain on the BBC, because there was only the BBC and they only had like a limited number of time for promoting music, so they never did it. So Radio Caroline was set up, a lot of radio stations, North Sea International, were set up outside UK waters so that the British could not get to them. The British eventually got to them. And one of those guys, Chris Carey, ended up in Ireland 20 years later when Ireland was experiencing the same thing. The actual broadcast law was written in 1932 and it was way out of date. And so lots of people could go on the Irish National Broadcast, go on pirate radio stations in Ireland. And that's where I was at the age of 22, you know, having been on lots of small radio stations that paid me no money. I was working at McDonald's
to support
pay the rent. And then Nova came along, the biggest radio station in the country. It had international listeners. It was broadcast all over Europe. It was like Radio Luxembourg. And I'm sorry, I'm going on about radio here, but that was a huge part of my life in the early 80s.
How did you get to be part of Nova? Did you get headhunted or you applied for it?
No one ever got headhunted, Ling Pang. You had to work real hard. And I actually sent in a demo. I don't know if you're, I'm sure, Ling Pang, that you're not old enough to remember, where you'd press two buttons on a recording machine and you would actually record your voice. And I just read from the newspaper. And here's an interesting thing, actually. There was a station called Sun. They called them Super Pirates. There was Radio Nova, obviously, and Sunshine Radio in the UK. Sorry, in Ireland and in Dublin. And they were called the Super Pirates. And Sunshine Radio refused me on the basis that I didn't even pass my Leaving Cert, which is equivalent to the HSC or HSC in Australia or... Yeah. A-levels in Britain, where many of our listeners are. I was told that I was not good enough because I didn't have all these credentials. Nova, on the other hand, which was now much bigger than Sunshine, said, yeah, you got a good voice, you can type. Welcome aboard. And that was it.
Did you get paid for that time onward?
Oh, yes, yes. Nova paid us well. I mean, you know, in a country like Ireland, the 1980s, it was pretty damn tough. You know, no one had jobs. Everyone was on the dole. I was on the dole. Mm. But Nova took me up and they paid us 100 quid a week. And I was blown away by this. I was getting paid for the first time after 10 years on working on these crappy little radio stations. I was suddenly getting paid to do what I loved. I mean, it was incredible timing. It was just, everyone knew us. We were huge. Nova was all over Europe and we were huge and we were illegal as well, but it didn't matter.
Let's have a break for a song. Elvis Costello, Radio Radio.
in the UK. Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Henry O'Donovan. What content and the material you were reporting?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I was actually a newsreader in the 80s, and that's all my time on the likes of Radio Nova. And there, by the way, for listeners who are listening in Europe, there's a new Radio Nova. It's not the same, okay? Mm. There are some people from the original Radio Nova, but there's a new Radio Nova. It's not the same. It's not nearly as good as far as I'm concerned. But the thing is, I was a newsreader and I was only 22 on the biggest radio station in the country. I was too young to really understand politics. I mean, we covered stuff like the Zeebrugge ferry disaster in the 80s.
Yeah.
We discovered, we uncovered stories that were breaking news, and we got it first on Radio Nova and related stations in that time owned by Radio Nova. And I didn't, you know what, Ling? I didn't really understand. I didn't understand. I was about to go to Australia, and I didn't know that at the time. But I knew that my life was changing, and I eventually left radio in Ireland and over to the UK. I went and lived in London. And you know, I just didn't, I was too young for my position on radio. I really was.
Did you like the freedom of being a young man doing radio and living in London?
Well, I think that, you know, by the time I got to London, I was not making money anymore. I mean, I'd been on the biggest radio station in Ireland, and all of a sudden I went to London. I had a nervous breakdown on radio in Ireland, and it was a part of my life that, you know, I feel terrible about. But, you know, all of a sudden my childhood caught up to me, and I was on this big radio station, and I'm going, I can't deal with this anymore. So I actually left radio in Ireland and went to London. There in London, no big money anymore. I was poor again, and it was shit weather. It was just awful weather. And there I was in London and thinking, where the hell am I going to go from here? And of course, Australia was beckoning. I met an Australian girl, New Zealand girl, actually, in London. And I know that you're about to ask about that. But London was actually a very, it was like this weird place where I suddenly went back to being nobody after being on this huge radio station. Mm. And I sort of kind of thought, well, this is it. I don't know what I'm going to do. I was in a lost place at this time.
You said you met a lady who became your wife and left London for Australia. That's a massive step, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And what a good time it was, too. At this point, I was 26. I'd been in London for 3 years in a place called Leytonstone, which I hated. Thatcherism in Britain was rife. I didn't like that at all. And I didn't like Britain. I didn't want to be in Leytonstone in the East End of London. I just did not want to be there. I just wanted to get the hell out of there. And I did. But the thing is, I didn't, you know, a lot of people say to me, you know, over the years, they say, oh, yeah, you met a New Zealander and you came to Australia. And I'm going, yeah, I did, but I didn't marry her to come to Australia. She said to me in a pub in Leytonstone, East London, she said, I said, look, I asked her three times to marry me, and the fourth time she said yes. But it was three times before that. And she wasn't, you know, she was a tough Kiwi. She was she is half Maori, half Norwegian. So she was an absolutely beautiful girl. But she just said, I said, look, should we go to Australia? Because we can. Because, you know, we're married and you're from New Zealand and I'm from Ireland and we can do this.
Yeah.
And she said, and I can't use the words that she said on air, but she said basically, to hell with New Zealand, we're going to Australia. And I thought that was really funny because she had never been to Australia. We met in London, but she'd never been to Australia. And I thought that was amazing that she'd never actually been to Australia. So we both arrived in Perth because my company kind of linked me up to their office in Perth. And the money was dreadful. And I just told them where to go. And we flew to Sydney. And that's what happened in the year 1989.
Sydney has a lot of meaning to me, even though I've never been there. My own grandfather, that's my father's father, had a business well before you got there. So I've always have a connection in my heart, but I've never been there.
You've never actually been to Sydney, and you've gone to your hometown of Hong Kong, which is just up the road. It's only 8 hours.
Yeah, it's another chapter of me. And it's about you. It's about you today. Your reason for leaving UK may have been to do with the government at the time. Margaret Thatcher was in power, and I understand you were unhappy about her running the country, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think it's fair to say, you know, in 1979, back in those days, you know, Britain was in a terrible place. There were a lot of strikes on. Thatcher came in 1979 and cleaned up all that mess. But then at the same time, she created a lot of mess as well. Mm. And by the time I got to the UK, she didn't give a damn about, you know, about people like me. She didn't care about poor people. And I was very aware of that. But Thatcherism is not called Thatcherism for nothing. It's called that because it was a kind of controlling force in the UK in that time. And you're in the UK, so you know what I'm talking about. It's very different what's going on in the UK these days. I'm not sure if it's much better, but it's different with the whole Brexit thing that's going on there. But, you know, we flew into Perth. We flew into a place called Bali, which is a beautiful island, a tourist island for Australians, and Americans seem to love it as well. We flew there, and we flew to Perth, and Perth was so slow after London. We just flew to Sydney, and you know, both of us have been here ever since. I'm not in contact with my ex-wife anymore, but I'm sure that she's still probably living in Sydney, even though she's from Auckland in New Zealand. And you know, it just went on, and you know, I went through a period where I was not on radio at all, Ling, because the internet, you know, back in the early 90s, there was no internet. Mm. And all of a sudden I was able to start a radio show, and that's what I've done.
So you got divorced from your wife after a few years arriving Australia?
Yeah. It was very small time of marriage, actually. I was only 28. I was 26 when I came to Australia. We divorced by the time I was 30. Here's the thing. Mm. You know, in London, living together in London was one thing. And then living together without all our friends in Australia, you know, in Australia, we had no friends. We didn't know anyone. She had never been to Australia before. Mm. We didn't know anyone. Mm. And we were just lost. And our marriage was a very short-term marriage, about 2.5 to 3 years. And that was it. Because we were both young enough to know that we had to make a new start. Mm. And it wasn't working for us. It mm-hmm. simply wasn't working.
So from the 90s onwards, you landed yourself a job with Dell Computers. That's a big company.
Of my nerve.
Yeah.
I'd worked for a company called TNT, which is international.
Oh, yeah.
It's a freight.
Yeah.
And I'd been working for them for 4 years. At this point, Ling, I was single, right? And going a bit mad with the nightclubs and that kind of stuff. You know, I left TNT to study psychology in college because I just wanted a change. I've been with TNT for 4 years, a big freight company. They paid me well. They were really nice people. Mm. But I just needed to change. And I was in my early 30s, and I thought, I've got to do something. But I got picked up by Dell Computers. And Dell, of course, was, you know, it's a huge company. Everyone knows what Dell is. But in 1992, no one knew what Dell was in Australia. They just moved in. And they were looking for bright sparks like me. I didn't think I was a bright spark, but they did. and they employed me, and they paid me good money to work in their offices on the north shore of Sydney, internationally. And there I was selling computers on the phone for about 2 years, I think, and then I gave up. And you know, at this point, I'd met another girl who I'm with to this day, Caroline, and she's been with me for 26 years almost. And we just met up and we said, to hell with Dell. And we went off to the country and went on the dole. We went on the dole. We had no money. And we lived in this place in the middle of the country, way outside Sydney, and had a great time. I mean, we did the right thing. In retrospect, I think we did the right thing because she was in her late 20s, I was in my early 30s. And we just thought, what the hell? Let's have some fun before all the serious stuff comes down. And the serious stuff does come down. So we had the best part of a year, I think, living in the country. And then we came back to Sydney and kind of woke up and thought, oh, shit, we better start making money. And we did. You know, everything went well. But we had our little break a little late in life. We weren't teenagers. We were adults doing this. And it was good fun.
So your girlfriend, she writes, doesn't she? She's a publisher?
Yeah, Caroline is a writer. She is a writer, but she works as a copywriter for a big company in Sydney. It's actually a British company, strangely enough. But she works for them. But she writes in her spare time. But she, you know, she's one of these people who always wants to write a book but never gets around to it because she's so busy, you know, writing for other people. But yeah, she is. And, you know, she always tells me I'm a writer. And it's funny because I'm actually writing a book at the moment. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I can't write. I'm a broadcaster. I talk. You see, this is the thing between me and the girlfriend. You know, Caroline is a writer. I'm a talker because I'm a broadcaster. And we always have this kind of argument. She goes, no, you are a writer. So I'm writing a book to see if I'm a writer.
This is Ling Pang for Bonang Tunes International. And I talked with Henry O'Donovan. We continue with the interview in part two.
In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now. Bongelico
007, licensed to sing. The James Bond film series from Eon Productions has had numerous signature tracks over the years, 23 in all, many of which are now considered classic pieces of film music. The best known of these pieces is the ubiquitous James Bond theme. Many other pieces of instrumental music have also become identified with the series, and various songs, many of which provided chart success for their performers. And it's the latter that I'll be looking at. So to 1963 and the beginning of Bond music. Although the series made its first debut a year earlier with Dr. No, its use of a particular song didn't come until that second film in 1963, From Russia with Love. The original Bond theme by Monty Norman was never recorded singly at the time, but appeared on the soundtrack album. Following the decision of the producers not to use Monty Norman after the first film, for whatever reason, though keeping his James Bond theme, Harry Saltzman decided on using the then popular Lionel Bart of Oliver fame, and he offered to compose the music and lyrics for a title song to the film. The producers chose John Barry to score the film. Barry had arranged and conducted the James Bond theme from the previous film. The title song was sung in the film by Matt Munro, an English singer who became one of the most popular entertainers on the international music scene during the 1960s. His vocal version is played during the film as source music on a radio and properly over the film's end titles. The ensuing main tradition of having the film song over the opening credit titles was to begin a year later with Goldfinger. So here's the Matt Munro recording, which became a minor UK hit for him after the film's release.
From Russia with love, I've fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to learn I must return from Russia with love. I've seen places, faces, and smiled for a moment, but oh, you haunted me so. Still my tongue-tied young pride would not let my love for you show. In case you'd say no, to Russia I flew, but there and then I suddenly knew you'd care. To you from Russia with
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.